The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This episode of the World War II podcast is brought to you by Audible. Visit audible.com/WW2podcast for details on how to download your free audiobook. Hello and welcome to another World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. Don't forget you can follow the podcast on Facebook. It's always nice to share other people's news and views. In this episode, I'm joined by Alexander Fitzgerald Black. Alex gained his MA at the University of New Brunswick. His thesis, Eagles Over Husky, the Allied Air Forces in the Sicilian Campaign, investigates the Allied invasion of Sicily in 1943. The invasion of Sicily would be the largest Allied amphibious landing at that time yet undertaken. After just 38 days of bitter fighting, the Allies conquered the island, but thousands of Germans had escaped capture, evacuated over the streets of Messina. The Allied Air Force had a crucial role to play, but it wasn't just over Sicily that they operated in support of the operation. Alex, thank you for joining me. So what was the situation in the Mediterranean in 1943?
In the turn of 1943, we have the big British victory at El Alamein, where Monty does his thing and starts pushing, slowly but surely, pushing the Africa Corps and the rest of the Italians back towards Tunisia. And then you have the landings in North Africa. And so you're at a point where the Germans are really hemmed into a bridgehead in early 1943 in Tunisia. And at the same time, you have this big conference that happens at Casablanca, where basically all the combined chiefs of staff meet from the UK and from the United States. Depending on what you read, you'll find different interpretations of that. But from what I've seen, the big message that comes out of it is the British were very much by this point, they'd seen approximately 3 years of war in this war, and then they'd gone through the First World War as well. So their chiefs of staff, I guess, they had their act together, whereas the Americans didn't exactly have their act together. The British had a plan that they said, you know, for the Mediterranean moving forward, we don't want to jump directly into, you know, Northwest Europe. Instead, we want to try to kind of grind the enemy down in the Mediterranean as much as possible, clear the northern shore of North Africa there, and then start moving into Italy and trying to get them out of the war. And Sicily was what came out of their thinking on that. The Americans, for their part, really, they didn't have much for rebuttal or a different mode of action. They were kind of caught flat-footed. And so the British plan essentially went forward. And everybody generally agreed with that at the end of the day. There were differing opinions and everything like that, but everybody was committed to that plan moving forward. So that was one of the big things that certainly came out of Casablanca.
What was their strategy going to be for the Med?
Well, so the strategy was essentially, you know, we're not in a position yet, you know, especially with the Battle of the Atlantic not won. And really the Battle of the Atlantic turns kind of in the spring and summer of 43. So that's, you know, half a year after Casablanca or so. You know, we're not yet in a position to get into Northwest Europe. We actually don't have the logistical buildup that's necessary to mount an operation on Normandy scale yet to actually sustain forces on the continent until the end of the war yet. So instead of going that way, let's go and try to eat at the Germans as best we can in the south. Force them to commit as many forces as they can to defend Italy, because if Italy surrenders, the Germans can't just let Italy go. There's a lot of, especially in the northern part of Italy, there's a lot of industry there that's very useful to the war effort. It's understandable that they would want to keep the enemy at bay and not let them simply move into the continent very quickly. And so the idea for the Allies was, where can we, at the same time helping the Soviets on the Eastern Front, where can we do the most damage in 1943? And the answer to that question, beyond obviously the air campaigns going on in Northwest Europe and the war at sea, is we can continue to make inroads into the Mediterranean, perhaps knock Italy out of the war, and get Germany to commit more resources there so that things get easier for us when we make our move across the channel in 1944.
So they plan on going, Sicily first. You can't really bypass it because it would be a almost like Malta was to the Germans. It would be...
That's right, absolutely.
So you have to take Sicily. So build up to the invasion, what was their tactics? What was their strategy for the Air Force at that time?
The thing is that the campaign flows very well once you look at how the North African campaign wrapped up. Essentially, what happens once Tunisia is taken, they now have this really big part of Africa that juts out into the Mediterranean right next to Sicily and Sardinia. And so that becomes a really great staging ground for long-range aircraft. So for the first time in the war, you've got a really direct line between air bases in North Africa and Rome. If you look at a map, you can see from Tunis or Cap Bon, which is the big cape that juts out of Tunisia, you have a direct line to Rome, to Naples, to a lot of the logistical nodes that the Italians and the Germans are going to have to manage if they're going to defend the southern coast of Europe. And so that's a big part of it. So there's a big effort that goes into getting airfields ready in that area and building up for heavy bombers and long-range fighters there, medium bombers as well. One of the things they do is they start packing squadron upon squadron of single-engine fighters into Malta, to the point where they're parking aircraft along taxiways and roads leading to the airfields, because they're just using them as really big aircraft carriers, essentially unsinkable aircraft carriers for the invasion of Sicily. And from Malta, you have a good radius of action over, at least kind of half of Sicily, I would say, kind of up towards Catania and a little bit beyond that. You have a really good radius of action for Spitfires and Warhawks and that sort of thing. The other thing the Allied air forces in particular do is they realize once they've planned landings along kind of the south eastern coast and the southern coast of Sicily around that southeastern tip, they also want to land in the Gulf of Gela, and that's where the Americans are going to land. But there's not enough space to park aircraft on Malta or Gozo to really give those adequate fighter cover. So what they do is they turn to the island of Pantelleria, and they basically unleash a bombing campaign against that island for about a week, give or take a couple of days, just pounding it with medium, light, and heavy bombers and even fighter bombers to see if they can get the Italians, the Italian garrison there, to surrender. There's a lovely airfield on that island that can also cover kind of the western part of Sicily and part of the American landings as well. And that really came out of... The Battle of the Atlantic is still going on, and the British and American navies aren't too keen on giving up escort carriers if they don't need to help cover the invasion. And so Pantelleria becomes an option from that standpoint. That's Operation Corkscrew is what that turns out to be. And it's interesting because in the literature, if you read about it, especially in the American literature on the U.S. Army Air Forces, people like Doolittle and Spots really tried to look to Pantelleria and Operation Corkscrew as evidence that an air force could essentially go it alone. They could bomb the enemy into surrender, essentially.
Like Bomber Harris. Just keep hitting him.
Yeah, kind of like Bomber Harris. Absolutely. And it's funny, it's interesting because Tedder, who was the chief of the Allied Air Forces in the Mediterranean, or at least for these operations at the time, was him and as well Conyngham, who was the tactical air force commander who provided some of the tactical bombers, the light bombers for this operation Corkscrew. They were both very wary of those conclusions. And as it turns out, Tedder's scientific advisor, Professor Solly Zuckerman, a South African, when he went in with his team and looked at it afterwards, they actually found that the accuracy of the bombers was really poor. The thing is, they're carpet bombing, so something's eventually going to hit something, which it did. And they disabled a lot of guns and that sort of thing. But what the real issue wasn't necessarily the fact that they couldn't have resisted. They probably could have. it wasn't just a morale thing. It was, you know, there was no sense in resisting anymore because they'd lost kind of about maybe half their guns. And a lot of damage was done to range finders and other devices that would have helped them actually target units coming ashore. There was also a bit of a water shortage in the sense that there was a lot of water on the island. They just couldn't move it anywhere. So that was another big problem because the air forces were pounding them so heavily that they didn't have the ability to move it around. And so that was a big part of why they surrendered. So whereas the American Air Force generals, you know, want to look at it as an example of, you know, air power can rule the world essentially and do it all itself. Really, it's a special circumstance where it kind of worked that way. But at the same time, it did still take basically the white flag didn't go up until the invasion fleet was essentially seen and until they actually tried to get, you know, permission from Rome to surrender as well. So the great thing about Operation Husky, Sicily, Italy, these campaigns is that it's kind of it's a real benchmark in operations research where we realize we're starting to move into Europe and we really want to see for the first time what effect our bombing is having on the enemy, right? So Palermo has been bombed, the big port on Sicily has been bombed since 1940 at various times, more heavily in 1942 and 43. And if we take that town, that city, you know, now we can go and look and see what effect our bombs were having. And it's something that we couldn't do in Germany, by we I mean the Allies, couldn't do in Germany until, of course, 1945, right? So that was a big part of it. And a big part of Solly Zuckerman's effort was to try to figure out what effect are our bombs having and how can we best employ them in the future.
Did he pull out any amazing statistical facts that no one had ever considered?
I'm not sure if he pulled out anything no one had considered, but one of the things he found is the best place to destroy enemy communications in terms of transport and logistics is actually marshalling yards. And the reason for that is because at any given time, they calculated that about 50% of Italian locomotives, wagons, coaches, and that sort of thing were concentrated in those areas. So yes, it wasn't necessarily about cutting the lines themselves, because of course, you know, a cut railway line can be quickly repaired. It was about paralyzing the transport system by destroying as many locomotives and coaches and their repair facilities, which are often located in these marshalling yards, as possible. Because if you destroy enough of those, the enemy will be overloaded and will be unable to deliver its supplies from one place to the other. Now, if they want to put a special train together because they have a special type of ammunition that needs to go somewhere, they can probably do that. But the system itself is unable to really service any big orders and to keep things sustained over time, because there simply aren't enough locomotives and coaches and wagons around, because a lot of them have been destroyed or in repair shops that have been destroyed.
In the build-up, did they attack the Luftwaffe? I mean, did they aim for airfields? You know, when the Germans were considering attacking Britain, they went for the airfields. They were hammered the RAF. Or were they mainly going for other targets?
No, you're right. They absolutely went for airfields. Airfields were probably their number one target. The way Tedder's air power theory, I suppose, goes down is there's kind of three orders of priority, and this also comes from Conyngham as well, is you need to achieve air superiority, not necessarily air supremacy, because in my view, air supremacy means the enemy essentially doesn't have an air force anymore. You need to achieve air superiority before you can do anything else. And so that's a constant battle. It's not a one-time thing. You have to constantly wear down the enemy. After that, you want to go after interdiction type targets. So you don't necessarily want to go after targets that are on the battlefield themselves, but targets beyond the battlefield that our artillery cannot reach. Things like the marshalling yards. And then third, you do want to help the army for sure, and go after targets that they've pointed out as being useful in terms of their destruction to help the army. But the number one priority is air superiority, and that's what the Air Force focused on for a lot of the preliminary bombardment campaign. One of the things they were able to do early on is they were able to drive the enemy bomber force from Sicily. the Germans and Italians basically said, we can't park our aircraft here anymore because the heavy bombers are now located in Cap Bon in Tunisia. And that's, you know, a really short flight to get to Sicily. If we want to preserve those aircraft for the landings, we need to move them away. And so they ended up moving them kind of upwards in the Italian boot north of Naples. And so for much of the preliminary period, those bombers were not useless, but certainly not, they weren't able to operate at their maximum efficiency because they had to fly long distances to get to Allied convoy routes and to Allied ports of embarkation. And so that really didn't help their efforts at all. So that's one of the big things that came of the preliminary bombardment campaign. Now, it's interesting because the airfields in Sicily themselves were constantly attacked. And actually, the way I like to put it is that the German and Italian fighters that were still based in Sicily almost had to start running kind of a guerrilla war. They basically had to kind of jump from airfield to airfield to try to avoid the bombers and constantly try to be up when the bombers show up so that they can at least have a chance at A, not being destroyed, and B, shooting some of them down. And so there's a number of large-scale battles that occur in the, especially in the really early July period between the 1st and the 10th, and even into June, where the Germans are trying to intercept, especially American bombers, B-17s during the day. They actually brought down Adolf Galland, the inspector of fighters from Germany, who was helping to lead the air defense there. And he tried to impose some of the learnings that they had from defending Germany itself in Sicily. And they didn't really go very well because their airfields were being attacked so incessantly that there was very little they could do about it. There was a couple of occasions when they tried to mass fighters at a single airfield so that they could all respond at the same time and go after the bomber stream, but their successes were rather limited. Yes, they shot down the odd B-17 and that sort of thing, but the thing that the Allies have going for themselves now is they have Spitfires in particular based at Malta that can help in the bombing leg of the escort mission. And the Americans have P-38s in theater, the Lightning, that are long range and can escort the bombers from their form up point to the target and back. And so the Germans are often, you know, that when they try to attack the bombers en masse, the fighters intercept them and then they get involved in rolling dogfights that don't really serve the Germans' purpose, because the only hope they really had was to try to shoot down as many big bombers as possible, because of course a B-17 carries a crew of over 10 guys and the bomber is replaceable, but the air crew that's taken a year or longer to train is not as replaceable. So that was the aim of the German Air Force in the preliminary stages, but they were woefully unsuccessful at it. And Johann Steinhoff, in his memoir, Messerschmitts over Sicily, basically admits as much. And he admits that the Allied air forces were incredibly successful in what they did leading up to the landings.
They'd be just swamped, I presume, even by 43, the Americans must have been absolutely churning out planes. And the Germans must have been increasingly starting. I was saying, that's not fair, because they're increasingly starting to struggle. They would be struggling to produce more, but actually the peak of production for most things was actually in 44, wasn't it, for the Germans?
Yes. And so they're actually ramping up, and they're able to send a lot of single-engine fighters, BF-109s, the latest models, as well as a Focke-Wulf 190 south. Now, the 190s, they typically saved for fighter-bomber-type roles, but they were getting their fair share of 109s. I think there's a stat out there that in Williamson Murray's strategy for defeat that they got, I think, 40% in the May to July period, 40% of the German fighter production went south. And that's a big thing that's been missed by a lot of historians when they talk about Operation Husky, is the fact that, again, the big picture is we want to wear down the German military as much as possible. And here's one of the things we can do. We can really attrit their fighter strength, and they send them down to a place where they don't have the advantage anymore. They have all of the advantages, just like the Royal Air Force had during the Battle of Britain, right, where the 109s could only stay over target for 30 minutes and that sort of thing. They have all the advantages up in Germany, and they're able to shoot down, for instance, there's a raid that takes place, the first Schweinfurt raid, which took place on 17th of August, 1943. The Americans lost 60 B-17s in a single day. I'm not quite sure the Americans lost 60 B-17s during this entire campaign. It's just, it's incredible. They're able to use aircraft in a much better capacity in this theater because the Germans don't have the advantages anymore. And that's a big part of why I think the Allied strategy worked, is because it's a place where the Germans can send as much stuff as they want, but it's going to get chewed up, and it's going to get chewed up at a cost that's not as bad as what the Germans, the Luftwaffe, is imposing on us.
Combined operations was kind of new for the Second World War. You've got all the arms working together, and how does it all fit together? Did everyone share the same before this, you know, before Sicily started? Did everyone share the same objectives, the Army, Navy, and Air Force?
The way I like to look at it is this. I like to look at it as, no, they didn't share the same objectives, but they shared the same goal. And each service has its own objectives that needed to be met in terms of achieving that goal. So the Air Force had to, you know, get air supremacy or air superiority. You know, they had to limit the enemy's ability to move behind the lines, and they had to help the Army to defend against counterattacks and to advance. The Army's job is to get ashore and to stay ashore, and to take key airfield sites and port sites as well, so that they can be reinforced one way or another. You know, the Navy's job is to deliver the Army and to give it some protection, because the Italian Navy does still exist and they're still a very real threat. So they have to screen. There's two big screening forces, one American, one British, that are operating in the Mediterranean during this campaign to make sure the Italians don't try to interfere as well. And so everybody's got their own objectives, but they're all influencing the same plan. The interesting thing about the literature is that the British literature is very combined operations savvy, and they actually use Sicily as a good example of combined operations, where the Americans would probably do the opposite. And part of that has to do with the fact that the British official histories are written as one. All services are included in the same official history for the most part. There are Navy histories and there are Air Force histories for sure, but the official history, you know, includes all three and is written by members of all three services. In the Americans' case, the Air Force has their own history, the Navy has their own separate history, and the Army has their own separate history. So I think part of the complaints about inter-service cooperation, especially on the American side, occur in the American literature because it's separated as it is. That was an interesting finding, I guess, on my part, where it was just the simple organization of how the history was done that probably had a significant influence. It wasn't a perfect combined operation by any stretch. There were mistakes that were made, and I'm sure we'll talk about them as we go, but It was a very well run operation for the most part. Yes.
I mean, do you think each arm, you know, they were realistic in their objectives, or do you think they maybe were optimistic before we actually, you know, they hit the beaches?
It's hard to say. I mean, if we want to talk about Messina for a second, I'm of the opinion that any objective that is to cut that node of communication and to seal the enemy back into Sicily, I think that is a bit far-fetched in terms of an objective. And really, that objective has been imposed on the history. It wasn't necessarily an objective in the plan or anything like that. And that is part of the criticism that a lot of people will lay, is like there was no real plan early on to deal with Messina as a problem. But really, what had just happened in Tunisia was you had a whole Mediterranean Sea between the enemy and evacuation. In this case, you have a half dozen miles in some sections of water to cross, and it's not that difficult to get across from one side to the other in comparison. So I think that expectation might be a little bit of a stretch, and I think it kind of falls from the fact that so many good things had been happening for the Allies in the Mediterranean recently, with the fall of Tunisia and then on the Eastern Front with Stalingrad as well. Big encirclements of enemy troops, you know, 300,000 estimated Italian and German troops surrendered in Tunisia. So that's a big haul, right? And the idea that we can repeat that is very much on the minds of some people, but I think it stretches beyond the abilities and the realities that are on the ground. So in that sense, I think the Messina piece is a bit of a stretch.
So the basic plan was just go in, get the island.
That's right. It's about getting the Italians out of the war And so we might have to go into Italy to do that. So Sicily will provide a great base of operations to do that. It's got a number of good ports. It's got lots of space for aircraft, especially on the southeastern side of things, and then the Catania plain, for instance. So it's really a stepping stone to greater things. And so that is the focus. The interesting thing, if you remember from the movie Patton, where Patton wants to, and I don't know that this really happened in that way, but, you know, Patton wants to land at Palermo and then, you know, drive right to Messina and that sort of thing. Monty is really right when he comes in and says the bathroom, draws it on the wall and says, our forces would be divided that way. We need to land in strength along a single stretch of coast, and it will be a long stretch of coast stretching from Licata all the way to almost Syracuse. We need to land there and take the enemy counterblow, because we know that's going to come. And it's more about getting ashore and staying ashore than trying to rush forward and get Messina. And so some would argue, well, that's a bit of a conservative plan, and perhaps it is. No one had ever executed a landing on this scale before in history. We have to realize that this happens before Normandy, and while Normandy is Normandy was the biggest effort until I think Okinawa in the Pacific, nothing on this scale had yet been attempted. And so it makes sense to go the conservative route to make sure you at least get ashore and you stay ashore. Because here's the thing. If you get pushed back into the sea, what does that mean for Italy? Suddenly Italy, maybe the Germans did most of the work, but it doesn't matter. Mussolini's able to use that as a huge, you know, look, we're still in the war. We just pushed them off of our own soil. The imperative is to get on the island and to stay and to make sure that happens, because if that happens, Mussolini will look weak and people will start pressuring him to get out of the war.
Okay, so just before we look at the actual Allied invasion, if I may take a moment, this episode is brought to you by Audible. Presumably, if you're listening to this podcast, you're interested in both the Second World War and enjoy listening to the spoken word. So Audible could be just for you. Audible is the largest host of audiobooks. They have a fantastic selection with over 6,000 World War II titles. In last month's podcast, I talked to Mark Zelke. Many of Mark's books are available to listen to if you want to delve deeper into Dieppe. Mark's tragedy at Dieppe, Operation Jubilee, is 13 hours of listening. Mark has also written about Operation Husky and the Canadian involvement in the invasion. That's also there. So for your free audiobook, go to audible.com/WW2 podcast. From my point of view, don't forget the WW2 podcast part of the URL and sign up for your free audiobook. So, Alex, let's get to the invasion. July 1943, the Allies invade Sicily. How did the Allied air operation perform?
There's mixed reviews for sure. A lot of the difficulty occurred in the American sector. I know, for instance, that the Americans at Gela had a lot of trouble getting armor ashore to meet the German counterattacks, especially the ones that happened on the 11th of July. And so they were very reliant on offshore artillery support from the Navy to stop that. A big complaint of Hewitt, Admiral Hewitt, who is the U.S. Navy commander in the area, was that a lot of their cruiser spotter planes were shot down on the first day, because they didn't have any air cover for those spotter planes. The Allies were very limited in their ability to provide support for the beaches. What they essentially did is they took some educated guesses as to what times would be most heavily used by the Germans in terms of launching attacks on the fleets offshore, and they tried to station squadron strength patrols in the area at those times, because they didn't want to just have a section of fighters trying to fend off a huge, you know, wave of bombers or anything like that. So they tried to make sure that they had a squadron of 12, you know, Spitfires or US P-40s above, you know, when they felt that the enemy would be coming over. It didn't always work out. There's a big complaint in the American literature that the Gela air cover was very poor. It's interesting, because one of the RAF historians who wrote a report on it was actually very critical of the American effort from the Spitfires based at Gozo. The Americans had a group of Spitfires based at Gozo. A group's about the size of a wing in American terms. And the RAF historian is very critical of them. And that's where a lot of the later literature went to say, hey, they didn't do a very good job. But when you actually look at the the sorties and when they encountered the enemy, the American Spitfire group actually encountered the enemy just as much on the 11th of July, which was the key day when the big Hermann Göring counterattack came in, as the Spitfire squadrons that were defending the British landing. So on the critical day, the Spitfires were actually quite effective. Yes, a lot of the spotter planes had been shot down, but the reality is that even without the spotter planes, the American fleet offshore was very effective in driving off that counterattack along with the infantry and other forces that were already ashore. So things didn't go as well as they perhaps could have, but they went very well in the circumstances.
How much air-to-ground support was available? How much power possible was it? I mean, we're still, radios are still in their infancy. I mean, or was it just a matter of looking for targets?
There's a lot that's been said about how effective the Desert Air Force was in North Africa. And part of that, I think, that effectiveness fuels this debate over how effective they were in Sicily and beyond. Now, that's a very different scenario where you have a desert on one hand and you have rolling hills and mountains on the other. But a number of scholars are very disappointed that it seems like the lessons learned in North Africa were not applied effectively here. The problem early in the landings was, again, like I said, the Malta and Gozo and Pantelleria all were full of single-engine fighter aircraft, most of which, yes, they could take bombs. You could turn a Spitfire into a Spit bomber if you wanted to. But if you did that, that meant fewer aircraft for escorts, for bombers attacking airfields and other targets inland. You know, it would also mean fewer aircraft over the beaches defending those beaches. And so they had to make hard decisions, and the decisions they made, I think, made a lot of sense. Provide the ground forces with as much air cover as possible, part of that being keeping a wing of Spitfires in reserve so that you can do fighter escorts over the southeastern part of the island to attack airfields and other centers of communication, because ultimately a lot of the BF-109s and FW-190s are operating from the island during the invasion, and you've got to keep suppressing them, as it were, as well. So those are where those resources are located. Now in Cap Bon, we have A-36 Apache dive bombers, which is a dive bomber variant that was very shortly used of the P-51 Mustang, and those were used with some effect, but mainly they were tasked, along with a number of P-38s, to provide support in terms of interdiction along the main roadways and railways leading to the beaches. So those are where those efforts are mainly concentrated. It's trying to help the army by hurting the enemy as they come down to try to counterattack, as opposed to being on-call fire support. Now, on-call fire support systems are developed as the campaign moves along. It requires a big network of telephones and radios and that sort of thing that develops over the course of the first 2 weeks after the landings. And so the real on-call air support that we like to talk about today, A-10 Warthogs and that sort of thing, really comes into play beyond kind of the 27th of July and into August, when Operation Hardgate, the last effort to push the enemy off the island or to drill through the enemy's defenses on the island, goes in. And by that time, you have Spitfires now based on the island itself. You have light bombers that can be based on the island itself because the Army's done such a good job of clearing out airfields for us. So the air commanders are very much operating within a number of limitations, in spite of the fact that we have overwhelming numbers, 2,500 or more aircraft committed to this operation. Doesn't mean there aren't limitations on how we can employ those aircraft. And so I think, in my estimation, they did a good job of sorting out who should do what and when for early in the campaign. And then as the campaign progressed and more assets became available, they allocated them to the artillery from the sky, as it were.
Yeah, it's just the man in his foxhole might not necessarily see what the Air Force is doing directly for him. It's all actually happening beyond his line of sight.
That's right. And I mean, they did actually provide, and I only found it with the Canadian division that landed near Pequeno on the southeastern tip of the island. Their division records suggest that there was a note that was received by all divisions that said, basically, the Air Force is not going to be over you all the time. They're doing other things that are just as important as providing direct support. So don't think that they're not helping you, because believe us they are. But of course, for a guy who gets bombed by the occasional JU-88 dive bomber that comes over, that doesn't really mean a lot, right? Because some things are going to get through. You can't stop everything. So that's where a lot of the criticism and the negativity come from, I think. And I think in the aggregate, it's a bit unreasonable. I understand, obviously, it's frustrating for the guy sitting in the foxhole, but that's the reality of the situation.
As the guy in his foxhole slowly moves his way up through the island, and the Germans are slowly pushed back, the issue of evacuation comes about. This was it was sanctioned as well by Hitler, wasn't it?
Yes. That's the thing. I think Hitler kind of sort of briefly learned his lesson from Stalingrad and from Tunisia, where he gave orders essentially, you are going to hold at all costs and, there will be no retreat. And in this case, he decided that, well, no, we have a lot of troops that are very fanatical. For instance, the Hermann Göring Division, I believe they used to be his part of his bodyguard at one point, although the members of the division on the island may not have been, but that was the division's lineage, as well as the 1st Parachute Division. You have these quite fanatical units that Hitler needs because once Mussolini is toppled on the 25th of July after the Americans stage a really large and the British at night raid on Rome, Hitler's attitude is we need to shore up fascism on the island because we're going to try to take over the island as much – or the island, I should say, the boot of Italy as much as possible because we want to disarm the Italian military and then defend the boot to keep the Allies at bay as long as possible. And so we need those fascist elements to drive up support for Mussolini's supporters who do still exist. One of the things he actually does is he actually I'm going to look it up because I don't want to get the name wrong. 2nd SS Panzer Corps, which is right now engaged, I think, at Kursk, this kind of really big tank battle that's going on over there. He actually orders them to disengage and to move south to Italy, not with all their equipment because they'll get new equipment, but because he wants those fanatical elements to be in place so that when you put Mussolini in as a puppet dictator, as they did later, you can have that support. And so 2nd SS Panzer Corps was composed of a headquarters and 1st SS Panzer Division and I think 2nd SS Panzer Division. Only one of the two SS Panzer Divisions ended up going south. But the point is that the Allied plan is working here. We force the Italians to capitulate, which means essentially, over a million men are now off the board. Hitler realizes, well, I have to shore up things in Italy and I've got to send some of my best troops south to do that. And that's a big part of this. That was the intent of Operation Husky and operations beyond it, is to get the enemy to commit forces to a war of attrition that they cannot afford and they cannot win.
Yeah, and he needs to get his men off Sicily. How feasible was that going to be with such hugely dominant Allied air power?
It's actually more feasible than you may think. And the reason for that is the Germans had a lot of experience because of the efforts that were occurring from Malta and elsewhere at air interdiction of waterways and the Navy as well being present. The Germans had brought in landing units and engineering battalions that were specialized units that could deal with these sort of problems. And a lot of them actually did get out of Tunisia and were in the Messina Strait helping with that traffic after Tunisia fell. And so you had these specialized units that set up essentially, I think, 5 or 6 different routes off the island. And the reason they had to do that was because the air interdiction campaign had been so effective early on, even before the campaign started, at limiting civilian and normal transport that existed in the area. I think only 1 or 2 ferries out of, I think, 5 or 6 ferries between Messina and Villa San Giovanni on the other side of the strait were even working during the campaign itself. And those are big railway ferries that are very efficient because you roll the coaches and wagons on, and then on the other end you roll them off and they go off. And so those are very efficient ways to transport things that didn't exist anymore because most of them had been sunk or burned out at some point. And so they had this very real problem that they had to deal with. And so early in the campaign, Field Marshal Albert Kesselring really put a premium on this sort of activity where we have engineering craft and Siebel ferries and landing craft moving between one shore and the other to make sure that the island has enough reinforcements for the battle. And those, in spite of all the air power the Allies possess, the fact of the matter is that there's a lot of guns concentrated on the Messina and mainland side of that straits. I think I counted in my thesis almost 400 guns, 390 guns of various calibers that existed on both sides of the straits and on the ships themselves that were ferrying and transporting. And so that was, you know, it was a very difficult area to operate in for aircraft. And of course, aircraft of this day and age are not very accurate. The only real way to attack anything on the move on the water with any accuracy is through dive bombing and torpedoes. And of course, the ships we're talking about are too small generally for torpedoes. So you're really relegated to dive bombing. And of course, when the ships have very good point defense weapons, like 2-centimeter anti-aircraft guns and that sort of thing, your accuracy isn't going to be very good because you're trying to avoid getting hit at the same time as trying to hit this very small moving target, relatively speaking. So the difficulties are certainly immense, not insurmountable, but I think at the end of the day, the real solution for the Messina Straits has to be the Navy's solution with the Air Force's help. And that didn't happen. And I think a big part of the Navy's reluctance to go through the strait had to do both with the coastal defense batteries that existed. We have to remember that Messina was a big naval base at the time. It was underused by the time of the campaign itself, but it still had its defenses that were potentially active. And so there were very big concerns about that and about being able to really maneuver in the straits with larger warships like destroyers and that sort of thing. I know there were motor torpedo boats that went and tried to kind of probe both sides of the straits, especially at night, but they didn't seem to have too much success in interdicting anything. So that was a big part of, I think, the Navy's reluctance to go and interdict the straits themselves, which is really the physical barrier is what would have done it if they could have done it. And a lot of the literature talks about how the British experience at Gallipoli may have played into this because it was the British who would have been responsible for going in to cut that artery. And it was, I think it looked a little bit too much like Gallipoli by their estimation. And so I think they were very wary about that as well. And the other thing you have to consider is that the Italian Navy is still very much potentially in play. So you have to maintain, you know, some sort of presence against that possibility as well. And so it's not as simple as sending your ships up there, see what you can see and see if you can cut things off, because there's other things we have to worry about. Another thing we have to worry about is, yes, we can try to cut off the enemy there, but we know we're going to be going into mainland Italy very shortly after this campaign ends, by the time of the evacuation. And so any effort that is expended on the straits themselves is a potential effort or losses that are going to impact your ability to deliver on the mainland campaign as well. And so in the big picture, maybe the decision to not let the Germans escape, because there were efforts made to try to stop them with the resources that were available, not to the extent that could have been done. But at the end of the day, they had to make a big decision here. Is it more important to cut the Germans off here and the Italians, which, by the way, a lot of people point to, but the Italians, you know, I'm sure some of them joined, you know, the fascist militias and the fascist government that was formed later in 1943. But for the most part, I think the forces that were on the island probably were sick of the war and wanted to just go home. So letting them get away is probably not a horrible thing. Yes, some of their equipment can be appropriated by the Germans for sure, but the Germans also have to disarm those people in about a week or two's time. So that's a bit of a headache.
I wonder if the Allies appreciate how many people were actually escaping. If they were doing it overnight, it must be very difficult to ascertain if you don't see what's going on because it's happening under the cover of darkness.
Well, some of it is. I mean, it actually started under the cover of darkness, but this is kind of one of the ironies of this whole thing is British and Canadian Wellingtons and Australian Wellingtons too were attacking both sides of the straits during this period at night. And what actually happened was that their accuracy wasn't all that bad. And on a couple of occasions, the Germans had to stop the evacuation at night because the bombers were so effective in limiting their ability to do what they needed to do to get their forces away. And so what ended up happening was they actually started evacuating during the day because they could rely on the 390 guns that they had to defend themselves, as opposed to at night where the guns are of limited effectiveness based on, you know, how well searchlights can operate and that sort of thing. So they kind of gave the Allies a bit of an in to say, hey, you know, we're going to evacuate during the day, come and get us. And the Allies, a lot of people would argue, they said, oh, well, fine, just leave. But, you know, in reality, what happened was the tactical Air Force was involved in trying to limit the evacuation, but B-17s were not requested to try to nip this in the bud. From my research, there's a couple of reasons for that. One is, when the B-17s were requested, they were actually not attacking beaches, but they were attacking like the ports at Messina and that sort of thing, because those were targets that they could hit. The other thing was that the B-17 crews, and here's another difference between this theater and the Western Front, if you will, in the air, you know, between the UK and Germany, is that the air crews had to fly more missions in the Mediterranean. I think they were at some points up to like 50 missions was the tour. A lot of that's because a lot of the missions were a little bit easier. German and Italian air defenses weren't what they were over Germany. But by this point in the campaign, a lot of the crews of the B-17s had been operating since early 1943 on a constant basis. And so they were starting to get to the point where they were going to, if they kept operation tempos high right now at the end of the Sicilian campaign, the Army Air Forces would actually lose a number of experienced crews who would be finished their tours and headed back to the States to take on their next assignment. And so that was a very real worry, I think, where they said, you know, they basically said, we can't spare too many missions at this time. Now, the missions they did spare ended up being air superiority missions. For instance, they went after at Istres, I think it's pronounced France, a big concentration of German aircraft that was there. I think they destroyed about 90 that day, but most of those aircraft were Air Force gliders to transport paratroops and glider troops and that sort of thing. But again, those are very real important resources for the Germans, and to eliminate them is a big deal. Is it better than letting four divisions worth of Germans escape? I don't know, perhaps not. But one of the things we also have to realize is that a lot of the Germans that escaped were wounded as well. Perhaps 40,000 Germans escaped, but there was another – the wounded numbered, I think, anywhere between 15 and 18,000. Sicily was a very bloody battle in terms of infantry, and the Germans paid a dear cost for it.
Did how successful were they getting? Were they just getting off men, or were they getting, you know, whole units and armor and logistic support, or was it just men they were pulling off?
Oh, no, they were definitely getting equipment. A lot of guns got away. I think there was 151 guns that they got away, which is, you know, they probably didn't leave too many that on Sicily that weren't already knocked out by Allied air power or the ground forces or even the Navy. So it's not to say that they didn't get a lot of stuff away. They certainly did. It's certainly a feat on the part of the Axis for getting away. But we shouldn't turn that into either the Pyrrhic victory for the Allies or that the Germans, you know, did everything they were, you know, asked to do. We shouldn't say, well, they held the Allies for as long as they could on Sicily and then they retreated to the mainland and did the same thing there. You know, I don't think that's a very fair assessment of the situation, because the German army that escaped Sicily is very soundly beaten by the Allied forces on the island.
Yeah, so there is this idea of the Pyrrhic victory that, you know, as you say, we knocked them about and they withdrew and, you know, left them to fight another day. But was it considered a Pyrrhic victory at the time?
It's really hard to say, because I think there were a lot of people after Tunisia in particular that felt that, you know, we've got the Germans on the run now. We've got the Italians on the run now. You know, we expect that we'll be able to cut them off in Messina just like we did in Tunisia. I think there was a number of people who felt that way. I don't think that's incredibly realistic, because it's a very different situation for sure. But at the same time, I think there were a number of people who felt that the fall of Mussolini and the capture of Sicily, it was just another point in the war where it wasn't a victory on the scale of Tunisia or Stalingrad, but it was another kind of notch to chalk up to say, you know, we've got the Germans on the run, we've got the Italians on the run, or maybe about to surrender soon. So that's, you know, something we should be proud of, and we've got to keep going. I mean, yes, a lot of the units that got away for the Germans were helpful at Salerno and at Anzio and other places along the line, for sure. But those units were really not the same units that fought in Sicily, especially among the infantry, because their losses were very heavy. It took them a long time to make good on those losses, for sure. And of course, that's a good thing where the Allies are concerned, because any reinforcement that has to come from Germany is a good thing, because we're drawing in troops that the Germans don't really have in abundance to defend the southern part of Europe instead of, you know, at Normandy or on the Eastern Front.
Where did the idea of the Pyrrhic victory come from? Is it a post-war revisionist justification of something, or where did that come from?
Well, certainly that's the language of Carlo d'Este. He's probably written the most read book on this subject. His argument is that, you know, it is a victory, but it could have been a lot better. Where I differ from him is, says, I think it's a very significant victory that hasn't gotten its due in the literature, because it is so influential on the strategic level at getting the Italians out of the war and that sort of thing. We shouldn't automatically go to, well, it could have been better, because a lot of things certainly could have been better. You know, Normandy could have gone a little bit better. The war on the Eastern Front, from the Soviet perspective, could have always gone a little bit better. But when you accomplish pretty much all of the objectives that you set out to accomplish on the strategic level, and you get that done, I think that's a very good record indeed. And just because we weren't able to really seal the deal and cut the Germans off at the pass, I don't think that's something that should take away from things. And this is a bit of counterfactual history, which I'm not a huge fan of all the time, but what would have happened? Sometimes it's useful to ask yourself a question like this. What would have happened if the Germans had been cut off in Sicily and had been surrounded and forced to surrender? Well, maybe they wouldn't have surrendered right away. Maybe they would have gone into the hills and waged some sort of guerrilla fight. I don't know. But one of the things that probably would have happened is the Germans might have second-guessed their desire to defend Italy. They may have said that, well, we just lost four divisions of really good troops in Sicily. Do we really want to hold Italy? And if they make that decision to maybe pull back to around Florence and just defend on that northern sector, yeah, maybe that means the Allies drive up the boot really quickly, and that looks really good geographically. We get places fast and everything. But that doesn't mean that you're killing a lot of Germans. And unfortunately, the reality of the Second World War is it's not necessarily how far you go or how fast you go. It's how many of the enemy you're killing and how many of your guys that you're not letting get killed. And yes, the conflict that goes up the Italian boot into 1944 and 45 is a very bloody one. And that's unfortunate. But the Germans continued to send units down into Italy to defend against the Allied pressure, even when the invasion of Normandy happened, and even when the Eastern Front is imploding because the Red Menace over there is making its advance towards Germany. So it's a counterfactual argument, and I understand there's flaws in that, but the what-ifs are, maybe strategically things don't turn out as well as we kind of hoped they would if we win that operational or tactical victory at Messina that people wish we had.
I think a lot of people with the whole Sicily campaign often overlook the fact that Sicily and Italy, Italy is very much forgotten. People overlook it is continually drawing people in. To be fair, it's drawing resources from the Allies, but we had deeper pockets for drawing people in. And it's amazing that they didn't just pull back to somewhere and stop. That said, Kesselring was very good at using what he had, which was minimal, to its absolute best advantage.
Yes, he was. He was very good at that, and that starts in Sicily to some degree. But I think one of the things that is so impressive about Sicily is that we are able to get off the island, to take the island, and get off the island in a month and a week. I think that's quite impressive. The fact that we're able to drive in on the German line around Mount Etna as quickly as we are is an incredible feat, because the Germans, again, they were going to hold on to the island as long as they could until it didn't make sense anymore. And that's what they did. We had to make it so it didn't make sense anymore as soon as possible to get the Italians out of the war as soon as possible, because ultimately the Italians are probably not going to surrender until you get to the mainland. And the faster you get Sicily over and done with, the faster that can happen.
Do you think that it was in the back of their mind that okay, we've got to take Sicily, but actually the bigger goal is to get the Italians to surrender rather than necessarily concentrate on the Germans. The bigger game for Sicily was actually the Italians.
Yes.
The Italian surrender.
Yes, and I think a lot of sources out there talk about how the Germans held on against an overwhelming Allied force. Well, the Germans were backstopped by a number of very good Italian units, a lot of Italian artillery too. So the Italians were very much a part of this campaign. You know, we can't forget that the Italians were very much in the war at this point. They might not have been the most effective armed forces in the world, for sure. But they could still make a difference, and they were making a difference. And so to get them out of the war was significant.
So very much, yeah, it's a very much a strategic victory for the, if you certainly if you pull back and look at the whole Mediterranean strategy, it's a big victory.
Yes, absolutely. And it's a big victory for the air forces in particular, because they are able to, I don't think this is technically a verb, but they are able to attrit the enemy at a very substantial rate at losses that are not, I mean, it's horrible, obviously, the loss of life, for sure, but they're not irreplaceable. And that's a big thing. I mean, some of the statistics I would point out before we sign off are the Germans lost, I think it's almost 30% more aircraft in July 1943 in the Mediterranean than they lost on the entire Eastern Front during the Battle of Kursk. That's an incredible statistic. The Battle of Kursk is huge. Everybody likes to talk about it as the biggest tank battle in world history. But we're doing more damage to the enemy air force down in southern Europe than the Russians are able to achieve on the Eastern Front. And that's a reflection of how much the Germans committed using air forces to defend the southern coast, because they didn't ultimately have a lot of army units to get down there quickly, and the air force can move quickly. So the air force was there to kind of buttress the defenses, and it unfortunately didn't work well for the Germans. It didn't work out. It's great for the Allies that they were feeding, you know, aircraft and pilots and air crews into this machine that could grind them up and spit them out on the other side. And so it's a big part of the campaign and the strategic reality that's happening.
I talked to Mark Zelke about Dieppe.
Okay, yeah.
There's a lot of discussion how much Dieppe influenced Overlord, and Mark's point was
absolutely
it didn't influence anything to do with Overlord at all. Husky was a better blueprint for Overlord.
I'd say he's absolutely right. I mean, if you just look at things chronologically, Dieppe probably influences Operation Torch, which probably influences Husky, which probably influences Salerno and then Anzio, and then you have D-Day. And so I think D-Day, we like to point to Dieppe, especially in Canada, because the guys who died needed to have died for some reason. And there's been more research more recently on that, and that's a whole other topic. But we tend to look, we go straight from Dieppe to Normandy just because they happen to be, I guess, in the same area code. But there's a lot going on, you know, in the Pacific as well, where lessons are learned and things are fleshed out a little bit more in order to get from Dieppe to Normandy. There's 2 years there, right, that has to take place first. And there's lessons learned everywhere, I'm sure. My expertise right now is on Sicily, but I think most historians would tell you that it's not as simple as going from Dieppe to the beaches of Normandy.
Well, that would seem like a good place to leave things. Thank you. Don't forget, if you like the show, join the conversation on Facebook and have a look at the website, www.podcast.com, where you'll find World War II related information that I discover and find interesting. I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.